pornography's influence on popular culture is more prevalent than ever. There is evidence that suggests pornography is linked with a broad range of harmful things that adversely impact the public health of our country. And we're looking at what consequences that has on individual lives, what consequences that has on our own communities. This hour of the morning show, we're talking frankly about a major public health issue that is really uncomfortable to talk about, and this conversation has to do with sex, and it's not suitable for all people. And our conversation today stems from the NPR series called Let's Talk About Sex. Kat Lonsdorf is the producer of NPR's All Things Considered, based in Washington, D.C. She reported on pornography for the show series Let's Talk About Sex. Kat, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey there.
And Emily Rothman is here. She's a professor of community health sciences at Boston University School of Public Health. She is a public health scholar on sexually explicit media and its impact on adolescent dating relationships. Emily, welcome to you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Well, Kat, let's start with this NPR series. You've been engrossed in making it. What is pornography, and how is it applicable to what you wanted to accomplish with these stories and interviews around sex?
Yeah, engrossed is a good word. This series has been pretty all-encompassing. But, it's hard to define what pornography is. That's a big, loaded question.
I wanted to bury it in there.
Right, exactly. It's kind of undefinable. You know, there's that famous quote that says, you know it when you see it. And I guess that's probably true. I'm not sure exactly how to define it, but, we came up with this series idea because we realized that, you know, sex was something that we really don't talk about much on NPR. We came up with it over a year ago, and it's just been a very, very long process to kind of put all the pieces together. And it kind of stemmed from this idea. We started thinking about it back during the height of the Me Too movement, and we were kind of thinking about how we talk about, you know, unfortunately, sexual harassment and sexual assault a lot, especially during that time, but we weren't really talking about sex as we kind of experience it, daily or most commonly. And so we developed this series, and we looked at a bunch of, you know, we've had a couple different segments air, not just about pornography, obviously. We've had one about talking to a couple who decided to wait until marriage to not only have sex but actually kiss, and that was a really interesting conversation with them about their experience. We've talked to we went to a town in Michigan and talked about LGBTQ sex ed, and kind of the debates happening in that town around whether to teach that in schools. And pornography just seemed like something we really needed to tackle in this series, since it really does kind of infiltrate our sexual lives and sexual experiences. Even if you aren't engaging with it, there's a pretty good chance that, you know, someone around you is. So we decided to take it on, and somehow I took it on.
Emily, there are conflicting statistics on just how many people watch pornography, but what is the best data that you currently can get your hands on when you look at how easy it is to find and see?
Well, that's a great question, and there's a couple of different answers. So there is one nationally representative survey that has been asking adults the question, have you seen an X-rated film in the past year since the 1970s? And what's interesting there is the percentage of adults who say that they've seen pornography in the past year has been pretty stable. It actually has not skyrocketed. But seeing it once in the past year isn't the same question as asking, have you seen it every day, or have you seen it multiple times a day? And so it's possible that if that question were phrased differently, we might see different patterns over time in how frequently people are watching it. That said, you know, other studies that have been done, for example, one that was done looking at students who are entering college, found that by the time that they're 18 years old, it's almost ubiquitous. Nearly everybody has seen pornography at least once in their life by the time they're 18. And that kind of matches our real-world experience when my research team, when we've gone out to talk to adolescents or even done classes on pornography literacy.
We're talking with Kat Lonsdorf, producer of NPR's All Things Considered. She reported on pornography for the show's Let's Talk About Sex series. Emily Rothman there. She's a professor of community health sciences at Boston University School of Public Health. You can join in 800-642-1234. If you're someone who grew up in the era of easily accessible online porn and have seen it, how has that helped or hurt the way you engage with your partners? If porn is here to stay, then where do you hope to see the public conversation around this going? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Emily, what has been the impact of the internet on the rise of pornography and where it is today on mobile devices?
Yeah, well, I think that it's really caused a lot of concern for people because whereas, you know, it used to be that you had to either physically go into a store or find pornography, maybe that your parents had hidden somewhere if you were an adolescent, now everybody realizes that if you hand somebody a mobile phone or you know, they're on the computer, people who are underage, so you're not supposed to have access to pornography if you're under 18 in this country, but people are concerned that adolescents are seeing pornography. And I think that some of the concerns about that are that people are wondering, well, what kind of impact is it going to have if kids are seeing the sexually explicit media in terms of their understanding of the mechanics of sex, what should happen during sex, how people should treat each other, and that they aren't able to understand that what they're seeing was made for entertainment purposes, that it's fantasy and not created to be sexual education, and that adolescents are turning to pornography for sex ed, particularly in places where they can't get it elsewhere, where we're not teaching comprehensive sex ed in schools or something like that.
And Kat, you spent some time on a university campus talking with students about pornography. Did you find that they can get access to it quite easily?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably not surprising. I mean, there's big tube sites that are, you know, like Pornhub, for example, which has some of the highest traffic of any site on the internet.
Even more than Netflix.
Yeah, I think that might be true. It has 100 million visits a day, and that's worldwide, but a lot of that traffic comes from the United States, and a lot of that's coming from people under 34 years old. Pornhub just has a ton of data because they are this giant site, but I was also surprised to find out, and this is just tells you how little I knew before I started really diving into the subject, but how much porn is on Twitter, for example, like places you aren't really thinking about running into it. Or I think maybe, you know, as a parent, you wouldn't really want your child on Twitter, but you wouldn't think they were going to stumble across hardcore pornography on there. It's all over the place on Twitter. You know, some of the college students I was talking to were talking about how, you know, friends will send each other gifts of porn. And so it just really is kind of this thing that will seep into your life, especially if you're younger and have access to a smartphone and the internet, which I think is becoming increasingly the case.
We're talking about pornography as it relates to sexual health. We're looking at the broader public health issues stemming from the pervasiveness. Building on this conversation from an NPR series called Let's Talk About Sex, and NPR producer Kat Lonsdorf stays with us, and she was closely involved in producing and reporting out this series. Emily Rothman is here, too. She is a community health sciences professor at Boston University School of Public Health. You can bring your thoughts, your questions, 800-642-1234. Parents, do you talk to your kids about pornography? How do you approach it? Or maybe you're trying to figure out the best way to talk about porn with a loved one or a partner. We've got a public health professor with us. Join in. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to the conversation in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about a difficult topic here in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We are looking at the public health consequences of pornography, and this hour's conversation is not suitable for all listeners. The National Center on Sexual Exploitation calls pornography ground zero for all things related to sexual health and well-being in our society. Access to porn is easy. A popular tube site called Pornhub reported its numbers for 2016. People watched 4.6 billion hours of porn on its site alone, most viewed on a phone. Do you have open conversations with your partner about porn? How has that impacted your relationship? If you're someone who grew up in this era of easily accessible online porn, how has that helped or hurt the way you engage with romantic partners? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. NPR All Things Considered producer Kat Lonsdorf stays with us. She worked on the NPR series called Let's Talk About Sex. And Boston University professor Emily Rothman is a public health scholar on sexually explicit media. So, Emily, there is something called softcore porn, and then there's hardcore porn. Can you tell us the difference between the two?
I can, although it sort of dates me, and it's a dated question in a way, because these are categories that we used to have for pornography. I think like back in the day when you used to walk into a store to rent, you know, a Betamax video, and you're looking for either hardcore or softcore porn, or sometimes on late night cable, they would show something that we would call softcore porn. Those distinctions don't really exist today if you were to go into Pornhub or something like that. But I can tell you that softcore porn is or was porn that was more likely to have a bit of a plot, and you wouldn't see close-up of genitals. With hardcore pornography, that was a term that people used to describe pornography that was that much more explicit, and you were going to see, for example, evidence, ejaculation, that people are actually having sex. So today, what you would find if you go on to something like the Pornhub website are very short video clips, usually like 5 to 7 minutes, and they all are what we would have called hardcore porn maybe 20, 30 years ago.
Why have we gotten rid of the distinctions?
You know, I mean, people may still use that distinction when they're talking about it sometimes, but I think that probably it's due to money-making. People realize that, okay, if we want to draw consumers to our website, what are they clicking on the most? What are they most likely to go for? And that they started putting the material online that was, you know, getting the most clicks, and that must have been hardcore pornography.
And Emily, you created a pornography literacy curriculum for teenagers. Can you tell us how this curriculum fits into sexual education and what's taught?
Yeah, absolutely. I was working with some folks at the Boston Public Health Commission, and this group of people had always tried to teach kids about dating violence and preventing sexual violence. One day when I came in to talk to them about my own research on dating violence, we realized that they were kind of tuning out. They actually weren't that interested in this talk about dating violence. But when one of my colleagues asked me about some of my research that had to do with pornography, the kids lit up. They really wanted to talk about pornography, especially I think when they sensed that there was someone in the room who was open to talking about it in a sort of, I don't know, non-judgmental way and answer questions. So from there, we realized, you know, we could use this topic of pornography as a sort of springboard into other topics that we really find important, you know, respecting boundaries or what is consent or how to treat a partner in a healthy way. So we don't have to announce we're having a dating violence discussion. We could announce we're having a pornography discussion, but really get at some of the same topics we wanted to talk about. So that's how we realized that, you know, if we put together a curriculum or a few lessons, and they are about sexually explicit media, but they're using the subtopics in order to steer kids towards contemplation about how they treat each other in relationships. The other thing I think that's important about the curriculum is that we use a media literacy perspective, meaning that we don't go into it with a goal that we want to turn all kids against pornography or that we're pro-pornography and we hope that they all grow up and see it. It's neither of those things. It's let's provide the best available science, the best available evidence that we know about pornography, and allow them to be critical thinkers and make up their own mind about what's right for them in their future.
Emily, do you see this curriculum evolving? Do you have to change it? Are there things that come up that you say, I have to tweak this?
Yeah, that's a great question because we've been talking about that a lot. We first drafted the curriculum in 2016, and I think we reflected the science pretty well up through 2017 in our published version of it. But the science does move on. We learn more and more things. And so we consider it a living document, and we are going to have to update it in order to keep reflecting the science.
Kat, for your reporting, you went to the set of a porn shoot in Los Angeles. And if you could take us there, why did you go there and what did you learn?
Yeah, I felt like if I wanted to do a piece on this, I really wanted to talk to the people who are making the content and not just the people who are consuming it. And I really wanted to just see kind of how it was made. I mean, there's pornography is a huge umbrella term, right? There's a bunch of different types. There's a bunch of different. There's amateur. There's mainstream. It's big, basically. So any set is not going to tell you everything that happens on any other set. But I wanted to kind of see at least for the more mainstream production, kind of what the conversations are that are happening that we don't see in an edited film. Right? Is like similar to what you would see on like a movie set, you know? And I wanted to just see, you know, how the director was directing the actual sex, what was happening, how the performers are communicating before they start having sex, whether there are conversations happening about what they do or don't want during the actual sex that's being shot. And so that's why I went.
And you talked to the director, Jackie St. James, about how she feels about young people who grow up watching porn. Let's hear a bit of that.
A lot of people that are growing up on porn somehow feel that what they're seeing is what they should be doing instead of really discovering what they want. And when I grew up there, you know, porn was so hard to get.
So what did you take away from her?
Yeah, Jackie was super thoughtful. You know, Jackie's in her 40s and she didn't grow up in this era of, you know, free online porn. She was talking about how, you know, she had seen porn when she was, you know, growing up, but it definitely wasn't something that could happen every day if she wanted to see it. She told me that she thinks, you know, she does think a lot about young people who are consuming the content she produces. She does worry about the idea that, you know, young women might feel pressure to pressure from their partners to copy things that their partners have seen in pornography, for example. That really got to her. But she did, you know, she did talk about. A lot of the people producing porn don't have control over their content ending up on these free tube sites, which I think is something to point out. And so even, you know, she doesn't have control over young people being able to see it, if that makes sense. And so it is this like kind of internal struggle with her where she appreciates and likes the content that she's producing, but she can't stop people who don't quite understand what they're seeing from seeing it.
And Jackie is female. How common or uncommon do we know is it for females to be pornography directors?
Yeah, it seems really uncommon. And I don't think it's the norm by any means. But I was asking some of the performers I talked to and they could list, you know, 5 or 6 prominent female directors who they worked with regularly out of maybe 20 or so directors who they normally worked with. And so I think, you know, it's actually more common than we think it is.
So on set, was it professional? Was it mechanical? What was it like gathering sound on the set?
Yeah, it was definitely a place I didn't expect to end up anytime soon. It was super professional. Like I said, I was at a pretty, like, very professional, above the board porn set. But, you know, call time was 9 a.m. When I showed up, there was a whole crew there getting ready. Carla Cush, the female performer, was in makeup and she'd been there before I got there. They, you know, were setting up the set, kind of having conversations about where the most comfortable place would be to have the actual scene happen. Jackie wanted to make sure both the performers were okay with where they were shooting and if they felt comfortable. They ended up doing it outside, and if they felt comfortable about that, and if they felt comfortable doing it kind of on this hard ground, she was very concerned about that. And yeah, it was I don't know. It felt like arriving to anyone's workplace, except that there was actual sex that happened, you know, 4 hours later. First, they shot the real, like, the scripted scene a couple times, and they ran through lines and everything before they did that. And then the actual sex was timed for 25 minutes, which I thought was really interesting.
We're talking about the pervasiveness of pornography, its implications on society and community. It's easy to access, more people watching it than ever. So what does that mean? And this difficult conversation was inspired by the NPR series called Let's Talk About Sex. And frankly, when NPR announced this series, I thought that, yeah, we usually don't talk about this, and we should. All things considered, producer Kat Lonsdorf is here, as is Boston University professor Emily Rothman, who studies sexually explicit media and its impact on adolescent dating relationships. Your questions, your insights, welcome, 800-642-1234. If pornography is here to stay, then where do you think it goes in the public conversation? Do you think literacy around porn should be part of sexual education? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll be back after this news update right here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about a sensitive subject, and that is pornography. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's the morning show, and I can tell you straight up that this hour's conversation is not suitable for all listeners, but it's a really important one to have when you look at public health. The National Center on Sexual Exploitation calls porn a social toxin, calls it a public health crisis. Over the past half century, the distribution and availability of porn has become normalized. We're looking at where we go next with your insights along the way at 800-642-1234. Parents, do you talk to your teens about pornography? How do you approach it? Or maybe you're a parent who's trying to figure out how to broach this subject with a teenager. We have Boston University public health professor Emily Rothman here. We have the producer of the NPR series Let's Talk About Sex with us, Kat Lonsdorf. And this open, sensitive conversation was inspired by the NPR series Talking About Sex. Kat, you actually went to a classroom at Cal State University Long Beach where students there were learning about pornography. And I want to bring in this clip of Shira Tarrant, the class's professor, talking to you about that.
When people are watching stunt performers, they know it's a stunt. When you go to the movies, you know that the movie was edited. And there's something about pornography where people suspend all disbelief or disconnect from the fact that they are engaging with a screen and with algorithms and with an editing process.
What do you make of that idea, suspending all disbelief when it comes to pornography?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the big question here, and it's the big reason why we wanted to talk about pornography and why I think it's important to talk about it. You know, Shira brought up this point that, you know, usually when you're watching porn, you're watching it by yourself. You're watching it with one kind of intended outcome, if you will. And you're not really thinking about how it was produced or whether it's, you know, that it was produced at all, really. And it's not the same as like going to watch a big Hollywood movie in a movie theater with a big group of people where everyone's kind of laughing at the funny parts and you get out of the theater and you can talk about kind of what you thought about the big, huge scenes and what you thought about, you know, kind of the production value and how it was made. And I think that's really the sticking point with pornography, not just with teens and kids who might stumble across it, but with anyone who watches it, really trying to think critically about what you're consuming.
Emily, what kind of effect does pornography have on LGBTQ adolescents, LGBTQ communities?
Well, I think there's a couple of things to say about that. First of all, I wouldn't generalize. So there's a couple ways in which when people ask the question, how does pornography affect, and they name anybody, kids or LGBT, mm-hmm. there's problems right away with that question because, as Kat said earlier, even defining pornography is difficult. That's a really wide umbrella term. And so referring to it all and expecting that it all has the same effect on a subpopulation is probably not right. And then it's also hard, you know, there's lots of different kinds of people who make up whatever subpopulation. So are these people who have certain kinds of personalities or certain kinds of, you know, tendencies already, and the pornography can interact with that or not. So there's lots of different kinds of people. So that said, that pornography is a different thing and people are different. So it's hard to make generalizations about it.
You can't compartmentalize. Uh-huh.
Yeah. 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 That it's broad and it can have varied effects on people. I think maybe there's one of the reasons you might be asking that question is that, you know, historically, objections to obscenity or what we call obscene, decision makers decide what's off limits and what's okay. We have a history of marginalizing LGBTQ plus people with what we call obscene and with what we call off limits. And we feel like it's important for when we teach classes on pornography literacy to explain the history of obscenity rulings and what obscenity is in order to highlight, like, who makes those choices? Why is something hanging in a museum and called art, but something else called obscene and off limits? So we have kids think about that and talk about that a little bit. But the other thing that's sometimes surprising to people is I think there's lots of people who assume all pornography only has negative effects on all people. And in fact, when you dig into the social science research on it, that's not true at all. There are some studies that have found some positive effects for some people. There's some that have found negative effects for other people, and it depends on the type. It is true that there are studies that find that for people who are really isolated, maybe they're a teenager who is feeling like they're attracted to same-sex partners, but they haven't met adults who are like that. I've had people talk to me about, and research reflects the idea that pornography can in some ways show, can help people feel like there's a safe space, and someday when I grow up, I'm going to be able to have the kind of sex I want to have and be the person that I want to have because it exists somewhere out there in the world. So that's just to break it down and kind of explain that, you know, there are times and places where pornography can actually help people.
Let's take a call. Oh, Kat, go ahead.
Oh, no, I just want to jump in quickly. I mean, I think it's also important in that context to point out that, you know, I talk to a lot of performers and, you know, people who producers and Jackie, like the director, none of these people would be making this content if they thought it had a wholly negative impact on society. You know, I think they would readily point out that they think that there's a very good place for it, for people who know how to watch it critically and can actually take it with a grain of salt, that it's a fantasy. And so I think that's a really important point to point out as well.
We're talking with Kat Lonsdorf, producer of NPR's All Things Considered, reported on pornography for the show series Let's Talk About Sex. Emily Rothman here, professor of community health sciences at Boston University School of Public Health. You as well, 800-642-1234. Gathering your insights, your questions about pornography along the way. Let's go to Jessica now, joining us from Chicago. Hi, Jessica.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me on the air.
Sure.
So I have sort of a two-part comment question. The first is to the point of folks are often marginalized by the designation of something as obscene is absolutely true. Something I've, you know, personally experienced. I think also sex work is marginalized by the designation of certain things as obscene, and sometimes by the regulation of the pornography market. I wanted to take a second and ask if you both think, or you all think, that it's possible that tightening regulations of pornography create a state in which we have allowed the government to further regulate our bodies, and we've allowed the government to survey our bodies or constantly observe our bodies, even more so than we already do. I know we've all got our little cameras on our laptops covered up with tape. Is this possibly dangerous for things like reproductive rights and other access to our own bodies, and giving up control for our own bodies?
Jessica, thanks for the question. Yes. Emily, I'll toss that to you first.
Yeah, well, this is a really interesting question because there are folks who are claiming that access to pornography or pornography existing is a public health crisis, as you said earlier. And I personally don't think so. I think that we have to ask questions about what's the impact of pornography on people and consider various arguments that it may be having some harmful effects on some people, and counterbalance that with this same point that your listener has brought up, which is, is there a public health impact or are there harms of calling something obscene, putting it off limits, and, overreacting or about it and underappreciating what any positive outcomes could be from it. So I think that we're in this place where we still need more to understand better the impact that it's having, particularly as sexually explicit media is unfolding in new ways, and to be constantly mindful of this fact that, the conclusions are not in. We do not know for certain all pornography is bad for all people. We still have a lot of questions that need to be answered.
Kat, I wonder, when you were on the pornography set, do you see that perhaps the director, Jackie St. James, is not held in the same esteem as a director who doesn't direct porn scenes?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, within her industry, she's certainly held to a certain esteem. But, I don't think she's like a household name that people would know in the same way that they would know a lot of big movie directors. And I think that probably also comes from just us not talking about the industry very much, We really don't talk about the pornography industry. And to Emily's point, I mean, it's hard to study something that we don't really talk about, which is really why we did this whole series, I think that that's really the most important part. And we can't really make these big sweeping decisions or assumptions until we first talk about a subject.
Emily, why do you think people, maybe even the students you teach, are willing to believe that porn is real and not necessarily a fully produced product?
Well, it's developmentally normative for adolescents to be curious about sex and interested to know how it works and how they should act when they're having sex. They're looking for clues about that. When they can't get that information elsewhere, and porn is right there, it's online, it's free, it's easy for them to turn to online sexually explicit media and look for clues about what sex is going to be like for them, particularly if they're sexually inexperienced. And then, unfortunately, they're not coming at it with that critical analysis perspective where they are thinking about the behind the scenes and how is this constructed and how is it created and how is it meant to sell something ultimately. So they're not recognizing that, and they often, I think, do make the mistake, or some of them anyway, that thinking this is reality, like this is a documentary, not this is a fantasy or entertainment. And that's where they might try to imitate some of it and can get into trouble.
And we're talking with Emily Rothman. She is a community health sciences professor at Boston University School of Public Health. Kat Lonsdorf here as well, producer for All Things Considered, had a big role in putting together the NPR series called Let's Talk About Sex. Your questions, your reaction to what you're hearing this hour, all welcome. 800-642-1234. We'll be back in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. This is a sensitive conversation this hour of the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, looking at the broader societal implications of pornography as it is mainstream, pervasive. There was a study published in the Archives of Sexual Behavior that found that 93% of boys and 62% of girls had seen internet pornography during adolescence. So where do we go from here if porn is here to stay? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. NPR producer Kat Lonsdorf stays with us. She reported on pornography for the show series called Let's Talk About Sex, which serves as this launching off point for our frank conversation this morning. And Boston University professor Emily Rothman is here. She's a public health scholar on sexually explicit media and its impact on adolescent dating relationships. Kat, you pulled a few students from the Cal State Long Beach class aside to ask them some questions. And let's hear a bit from David Cruz, which is one of those students.
When I realized that porn wasn't reality was when I first started having sex. It didn't last for an hour and a half. And the expectation was that we're going to dry all these moves and things are going to get done. But I quickly learned that, I don't know, it takes connection building and all kinds of other factors that lead into what works for specific people and certain couples.
That was very transparent, very bold, I suppose, of him to just reveal all of that to you, Kat. What are your reflections on what David is saying there?
Yeah, those students were great, first of all. They were really, really open, which was awesome. I mean, I think that he's not in the minority there. I think that if you polled a lot of young, you know, 20-something and younger, maybe even 30-something and younger men and women aside who grew up in this age where internet porn is free and easy to easily accessible, they would all have this kind of aha moment. Maybe not that same exact one, but a moment where they had first, like, porn was their first kind of introduction to sex. And then once they actually started having sex with a partner, they had to kind of re-figure out what it meant to have a connection with someone because they had been watching, you know, this constructed fantasy. And that was really how they first learned about what sex was, what they thought sex was supposed to be. And, you know, David especially was really frank and open, and he was very adamant that he hoped more conversations would be happening like this very same one, because he said that he this didn't make my piece, but he was talking about how, you know, he had felt lost for a while, having watched porn before and kind of stuck in this hole of lack of understanding of trying to figure out the difference between the porn he had seen and as he started to have sexual relationships. And I don't think that he's in the minority there.
So he kind of felt like he could see the disconnect between reality and what he was seeing through porn sites or what he was seeing on his phone.
Yeah, well, but only in, like, 2020 hindsight, you know?
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
I think that it took him a while to figure that out. And a lot of the, you know, young women I was talking to from that same class were talking about how in some of their, you know, past sexual relationships, they'd felt like their partners had been, you know, trying certain porn moves on them without really talking to them about it. And it's awkward, and it's also – it's more than awkward. It's not like – it's just – it can hurt. And, you know, it has real implications.
Let's take another call now. Let's go to Ian joining us from La Crosse. Ian, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me on the air.
Sure. Go ahead.
So my question was what the porn industry's impact on the LGBTQA community is. Coming from experience as a gay adolescent, watching porn was almost the only way I could connect with the LGBT community. And it made me feel less ashamed of who I was as a person who enjoyed or was gay and found men attractive. And there was just no other people around to talk to about that sort of thing. And that was one way that I just didn't feel ashamed of myself.
Thank you so much, Ian, for that. Emily, your thoughts there?
Well, I thank Ian for that comment, and I think it resonates because I've heard similar comments from many people, and we actually see it in the research literature as well, that there can be ways in which pornography is helpful to some people. There's the right time and a right place for some of it. At the same time, I think embedded in that comment is something else that's really important, which is that Ian and other people shouldn't have to turn to pornography in order to get validation for who they are and what they want to do sexually. And so it's really an argument for providing comprehensive sex education in every school and to every adolescent. You know, rates of self-harm, depression are high among LGBTQ PPIA communities. And so anything that we can do in order to not have pornography be the only place where people can go to feel validated is going to be really helpful.
Ian, what do you think about that? Your thoughts on sexual education?
I think it's a really difficult situation in general. I think that right now there's just not that access to the LGBT community for anything else except pornography, especially with funding, things like that. Like in La Crosse, we have an LGBTQA center, which is great. But even in places like Minneapolis, there is no LGBTQA center. There's no place for people to go and be themselves and ask questions and things like that. So I think, this being the only educational tool right now for so many places for the LGBT community, it's difficult to say, is porn, a bad impact right now? Versus, 20 years from now when there will be this funding for LGBT youth.
Yeah, and Emily, how privy are parents to their teens' exposure to pornography?
It's hard for me to know in general. I think that as adolescents are getting more and more savvy on how to use technology, there's a lot that parents don't know. And in my experience through research, I think there's a lot that parents sometimes deny to themselves or sort of hope that somebody else is going to take care of. To be fair, parents may not be the best position to talk to kids about pornography. I think in part that's why our pornography literacy curriculum has worked, or parents have been glad to say, sure, I'll send my kid through that class, is because trusting somebody else who knows the science to talk to the kids about pornography is really an advantage, especially if parents are uncomfortable talking about the topic themselves.
What kind of impact has your class had on those students? Have you seen differences at the end?
Yeah, well, we didn't use a control or comparison group, so we can't attribute all the differences to the class necessarily, although it does seem unlikely that they would have been learning about pornography from somewhere else. And what we did find by giving a pretest and a post-test before and after the class to the kids who went through it is that some of their knowledge about pornography and the reality of how it's made or how it's constructed, or the fact that, there's an industry with money, like their knowledge about it changed, some of their attitude about whether it's an easy way to get rich quick or something like that by being in pornography, that seemed to change. And importantly, their behavior around how frequently they watched pornography did not change as a result of going through a pornography literacy class. So it's not like it encouraged them to run out there and watch pornography, but it did seem that their knowledge and attitudes changed healthfully over time from taking it.
Kat, I want to land here with you, end with you. Where do you hope to see this conversation go as you've done this reporting and this series around sex? Where do we go from here?
That's a really good question. I think that the whole point of the series and the point of the piece is just to hopefully start a conversation. I mean, like Ian, the caller, just said, there's this huge sense of shame around even admitting that you watch pornography. And I think that that is really part of the reason that we're not talking about it. It's also a super awkward conversation. It's a super awkward conversation to turn to your partner or your child or whoever or your friends and discuss pornography, because it's such a solo activity generally. And it tells us about our fantasies and all that kind of stuff. But I really just hope that people take the chance and start talking.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Kat Lonsdorf, producer, NPR's All Things Considered, based in D.C., reported on pornography for the show series Let's Talk About Sex. We have a link to that series at WPR.org on the morning show page. Emily Rothman, professor of community health sciences at Boston University School of Public Health, looking at sexually explicit media impacting adolescent dating relationships. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.